Every time I talk about Red Dawn, people always say the same thing. Oh my God, I love that movie. I love that movie. Oh, I watched that movie when I was a kid. It's the best movie. And if you're of a certain age, if you're a millennial, if you're Gen X, you know this movie. This movie comes out in 1984. It's the height of the Cold War, the Reagan era, the fears of global nuclear annihilation, of Soviet invasion. And this movie packages all of that together all at once to talk about how American resistance alone, the United States stands alone in the world in 1984, how we are going to turn the tide against the Soviets. So I wanted to talk about this movie. We actually recorded this pod a second time. This very first time we did this, we actually did this live. I brought on my great friend, Kathleen Ballou. Now, you know Kathleen. She's on Twitter. She's probably one of the most well-known historians in the country at this point. She's also a very good friend. And we did this podcast live in Denver, of all places, back in December of 2023. We did this at the Society for United States Intellectual History annual conference. And then we did a version of this at Wincoop Brewery, which is this amazing place in Denver. If you haven't been, it's really great. It's got great beer, great food, and all that. And we did this live that night. We had hundreds of people in attendance. So much fun. It was so loud. You couldn't hear a damn thing. The only people talking were me and Kathleen. And I promise you, we had a great time. But we've been trying since then to have this podcast. Since then, we just sat down, and after 3.5 months, finally were able to sit down and record a new version of this pod where we're talking about Red Dawn, what it means, how we relate to it, and its long-term effects. We also, as she and I are wont to do, we talk about everything else under the sun, from the best places in Colorado to find food to where to go skiing and all this kind of stuff. It's a rambling, awesome, fun conversation. That's what you get here at HATM. So I hope you enjoy this. I hope you're yelling Wolverines as you listen to this podcast, because Red Dawn is next on the Historians of Movies podcast. Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
Great. How are you?
I feel like this is the 47th attempt we've done at this podcast.
I almost thought we were cursed about Red Dawn, but now I know it's all going to work out okay.
Is it? Well, here's the thing. Okay, so people listening in right now should know this is our second time doing this pod. Like, we did this in Denver at the Wincoop, a place that haunted me that you were like, we have to go anyway. I was like, oh, fucking places you made me go.
No, and it looked like it was going to work out so nicely. And then it turned out nobody could hear a single word we said.
I know, right? And had, look, and here's the thing. Had we done the pod, like, it was an amazing, like, our conversation was awesome. Like, we were ripping. And it was great. And we also had lots of drinks. And that was fun.
That was a lot.
And then we had a lot of drink. I was like, I would look at the bars like, this guy.
And there was pie, because my mother made pie.
She made pecan pie.
It was great. However,
it was great.
The acoustics were maybe not that great. So the people who were persevering, trying to listen to us, thank you very much for doing that.
People had a good time.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a bar fight.
What?
There was a bar fight.
I missed the bar fight. Was there seriously?
No, there was no bar. I wish
there was a bachelorette party.
There was a bachelorette party, like that, and they were cool about it.
They were cool about it, and they were like, they got into it for a minute, but then they had to like peace out to their next location. They get it. Like, Red Dawn is a vibe that I would not necessarily think would go with bachelorette party.
I don't know. I've never been to a bachelorette party.
Your kind of bachelorette party.
I don't know. I've never. So we're going to be doing Bridesmaids on the pod soon. And we're going to do a watch along instead of like the usual, like we watch it and can think about it.
Yeah.
Like, I've never seen the film. But so me and the women who did the Dirty Dancing pod are going to come back on and watch Bridesmaids in real time, because they're like, Jay, let's watch this together. And I'm like, this is one of two live. We're going to do this one. Have you seen La La Land?
Yes.
Okay, so Thomas Lecoq wants to do that. And I think just so he and I can sit and cry together for like an hour and a half, 2 hours, and then talk about jazz. So I don't know how to segue back this. People have strong feelings about Red Dawn. There's my segue.
They do. Lots of feelings. There's lots of feelings everywhere. That's our segue.
Okay, that is our segue, because here's the thing. Whenever I was posting out, whenever you and I first started talking about this, you and I both have like strong personal ties to this, for this particular film. But like, when I would talk to people about Red Dawn, the first response of people of my generation, and I'm late Gen X, right? So I'm born in 77. The people in my generation are like, oh my God, I love this movie. Like, and so it's almost always guys that I talk to about Red Dawn. You know, it's not like you get on Hinge and be like, so Patrick Swayze, right? Or anything like that. But like, maybe that might work. Back, you know, back when I was on there, I used to hit with like a date with the thing. What was it? I used to say I'm the real dread Pirate Roberts. Killed. Absolutely killed.
Oh.
Slayed. But now people are like, don't want to do that. Anyway. Where's it go with it? Red Dawn. People love Red Dawn.
It was I think it was a formative generational movie. And mm-hmm. I also think it's a really nice, one of my cousins who joined us in Colorado for the live version was talking about how to him, it was not really a political movie so much as the like a woodsy survival, like, you know, self-reliance kind of movie, which is definitely not how I tend to view it. But I do think a lot of people have that sort of thought about it, right? Like it's part of an apocalypse story, I think, is always about like, could I make it? Could I survive? That strand is certainly there in that movie. And because they're children and teenagers, I think it's, you know, available to children and teenagers imagining that.
Well, I think so. And I think it, I mean, and I think that, you know, in a lot of ways, like the film is using these images of like the idea. I mean, they're quite literally playing Indian and playing a mountain man in this movie, right? To like tell these very political, overtly political messages about like American you know, exceptionalism, also our ability and our duty to fight for America and things like that. I mean, they're really kind of playing on a lot and going far enough back in like American history, all the way back to the colonial era. People have always been playing on these ideas of this rugged American man who can defend America with his know-how and his you know, understanding of the terrain and his sidearms and his blue Chevrolet pickup truck.
Yeah. And his plaid shirts, his leather jackets, and, you know, it goes on like this.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So people come into this pod for the first time. We're going to jump into this phone for a second. You want to introduce yourself and, like, why you're here?
Oh, yeah, sure. Hi, I'm Kathleen Ballou. I'm an associate professor of history at Northwestern. My first book, Bring the War Home, the White Power Movement and Paramilitary America, talked about the social movement, the white power movement that came together in the late 1970s using the stories we just discussed, but also using the idea of government betrayal in Vietnam, warfare, veteran identity to bring together neo-Nazis, Klansmen, tax resistors, and then later skinheads and militiamen into one movement that was attempting to overthrow the government. It's the movement that goes up to the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, and it's the movement that reaches forward into more recent events like Unite the Right and the January 6th insurrection. So Red Dawn has a huge place in that movement. It's one of the sort of imaginative favorite texts of that movement. It is referenced a lot in the white power ecosystem. It was Timothy McVeigh's favorite movie. So it does a lot of sort of imaginative work that is useful to the white power movement. Now, that's not to say that everybody who likes this movie is part of that movement. And certainly, if you're, you know, a Patrick Swayze stan or a childhood survival kid who just really loves this movie, don't worry or anything. But from where I'm sitting as a historian of white power movements, I think it tells us a lot about how the ideology kind of works and how the imaginary landscape looks in the 1980s.
Yeah, this is a fascinating movie and a little bit more directly related to your previous pod that you were on.
Yeah.
When you came on to do Con Air, which I think was so much fun.
I love Con Air.
Oh, we're going to come back. When we get Nick Cage on, you're coming back on and we're going to do like a Nick Cage. It's coming. Like I'm getting Nick Cage on here eventually. So, all right. And you're absolutely right. Right. This movie kind of goes across all these demographics. People really latch onto it. I think people, it's directly marketed at people in late Gen X, early millennials. These groups all grow up watching this film. It's on HBO and TBS and all this stuff. So it's like nonstop. Yeah. And I remember as a kid at my grandparents' house in Western Kentucky, my brother and I would go down and we would play Red Dawn. Like there were these gullies next to the house and we'd go hide and we'd pretend the Russians were coming and the Cubans and all these people. So it was like, and we'll get into this in a bit, but it was like, for us as children in the 1980s, this movie was very much a fantasy about being American. and sure. doing our part, right?
And I think, like, you know, notably, you don't have to be at all extremist or at all even on the right in the early 1980s to kind of affiliate with the imaginative tropes of Red Dawn. So we could think about, is Red Dawn 83 or 84?
84.
And so then the day after is 83. So the day after, for anyone who's not familiar, is like the big movie of the week that even kids are encouraged to watch. That is like just a incredibly violent, incredibly hopeless depiction of nuclear warfare in Middle America. I think Nebraska, but in Middle America. So those two films together, I think, really paint a picture of a whole country that is still very preoccupied with the Cold War and very concerned about exactly how this is all going to shake out. It's interesting for my undergrads because in one way, like for them, I think 1984 and 1989 are kind of the same, you know? But like that, the contingency of that moment in the early 80s when the Cold War isn't decided, when all the bombs are still pointed at the United States and at Russia, and when people are quite worried still about how close Cuba is to the border and how close the Sandinistas are to the border and what's going on with the dominoes in Central America and on and on and on like that. I mean, these are mainstream issues that that are being mobilized here.
Yeah, you know, this movie plays on so many of those fears, and they're so, I mean, just in a lot of ways, Milius does the audience, especially historians, right, this like great favor of saying, this is what we are thinking about in 1984, right? And I was going to make this smart-ass crack about like how people in Nebraska watching The Day After were obviously in tune for this, because like, the world is already over. You live in Nebraska. I'm not worried about like, our Omaha demographic here on the pod. But at the reality, like when you look at the plain states, all those missile silos are in Kansas and Nebraska and the Dakotas. These guys, even as insulated as they are living very much within the confines Absolutely. Of the threat of nuclear war.
Yeah. Right? I love Gretchen Huefner's book about this, The Missile Next Door, about how much the heartland is a battleground in the Cold War, particularly in the 1980s, and particularly as nuclear payloads get bigger and bigger and they need more space for silos and all of that. So I think that, well, and I mean, I think Colorado is also important to the story in that way because of the presence of NORAD, which is the big North American response. North Atlantic. What is NORAD? North Atlantic something aerospace defense, something in aerospace defense. Anyway, the big center of operations that's inside of Cheyenne Mountain is also being built and then launched in this period. So the movie War Games, I think, also comes out around the same time, which depicts the inside of NORAD. So Colorado particularly is very involved in the imagining of the Cold War and in kind of fighting it from afar via Lockheed and Martin Marietta and all of the manufacturing going on at Rocky Mountain Arsenal and Rocky Flats. So all of this in the heartland is mobilized, even though, you know, the detente is so close.
Well, it's so much, right? Like, so Colorado plays this huge character.
Yeah.
In the film. I remember even as a kid, I was like, why would they invade Colorado?
Yeah.
Why would they invade a school? Right. We'll come back to that in a second. For people listening now, you know that I'm in Colorado right now, where this podcast is not brought to you by my employer. I should probably put that one out specifically for this episode.
We tried to do it live in Colorado because it's a Colorado right. movie.
We did do like, but
yeah,
the only people can hear is you and me.
Yeah.
It is a Colorado film.
Yeah.
Right. And for so many reasons, right. Colorado is quite literally in, you know, in the heart of the country. You've got this and really kind of where the plains, you know, this is set in the ARP, and where the plains kind of smashes into the mountains, right? And then I remember this, like, how are you going to get a bunch of Venezuelans and Cubans in it? Or Nicaraguans, was it?
I think it's Nicaraguans because they come up. Nicaraguans, I assume that they come up through Texas because, again, Reagan is very concerned about that. But the mountains are really important because if you're in Nebraska, you don't have mountains to escape into. And the escaping into the mountains is a very important plot device several times in Red Dawn.
No, I mean, if you're in Nebraska, the only place you can go is Missouri, right? So, and I'm thinking what I'm praying for at that point in time is total global nuclear war. I'm just like, I'm not going to Missouri.
Okay, let's not go for total global nuclear war right now.
Fine. Okay. Go ahead.
I was just going to say we should talk about the setup screen. Oh, you're already there.
I was literally about to read it to you. Okay. All right. I also have the password for Wincoop Brewing on the top of it as well. All right. You ready?
Yeah.
Here we go. In my most ominous voice.
Okay.
Soviet Union suffers worst wheat harvest in 55 years. Labor and food riots in Poland. Soviet troops invade. Cuba and Nicaragua reach troop strength level goals of 500,000. El Salvador and Honduras fall. Greens Party gains control of West German parliament. Demands withdrawal of nuclear weapons from European soil. Mexico plunged into revolution. NATO dissolves. United States stands alone. I got shivers.
All the dominoes have fallen, in other words.
Dominoes have fallen, Reagan, yeah.
Domino metaphor. And this is when Reagan is giving the speeches about like how long it takes to drive from Nicaragua to Texas. He says 2 days, by the way, which is insane and certainly not possible with the roads even as they are now, but definitely was not possible with the roads as they were then. Anyway, so Honduras and El Salvador falling means the Nicaraguans can come north through Mexico and then perhaps accruing Mexican soldiers along the way. But that'll be important to our movie in a minute.
You know, I'm kind of wondering, because I want to address this right off the bat, actually, about this migration thing, because when we look at the sociopolitical landscape of the United States right now,
yeah,
and who's really drawing out fears of migration and what they're bringing, the migrants, quote unquote, are bringing into the United States, and who these folks are, the age group to me, and I'm looking at the specific people who were just maybe a few years older than me or a few years younger than me, say 55 to 40,
yeah,
would have seen this film. And I'm kind of wondering if this movie plants or at least is an exemplar of the fears of migration, and then that kind of gets taken up by politicians at some point in time to like make these stories. I wonder what the correlation is between like what we're seeing in this film as far as like fears of migration,
yeah,
and people coming across the border into the United States.
I wonder about that too. It might be a little bit chicken and egg because I think people are concerned about it before the film. I mean, John Birch Society is, I think, the first people talking about the possibility of tanks coming over the southern border in the Cold War. But I know that they worry about that even in World War II, before John Birch. So on the other hand, we do have a consistent use of anti-immigration tropes by the white power movement in this moment and into the present that has to do with communism. So when we see Proud Boys marching around with like the Pinochet was right shirts and the helicopters talking about how, you know, communism is a threat to our country again, that's playing directly on this same set of issues.
I wonder, you know, there's this whole thing about the Proud Boys and the white militarism. Yet the leader of the Proud Boys himself was he Cuban American? Is that correct? Yeah, like there's this whole
he's Cuban American and he's Afro Latino. So you know, that's a complicated one.
there's some real acrobatics going on mentally, yeah, to kind of get to these spaces, are there not?
For sure. So here are there's a variety of things I think we have to remember. One is that the white power movement is looking for alibis of its racism. So it uses people for that reason. Another is that when we're talking about Latin American populations and Latinx folks in the United States, we are often talking about an entirely different structure of whiteness that has to do with relative amounts of indigenous heritage versus Spanish heritage. And then also the African heritage alongside sometimes doesn't figure and sometimes does. So people can have ideas of themselves as white actors, even though it doesn't match what a typical American, U.S. American notion might be. All of it is complicated. And I think, you know, historians also know that whiteness is constructed. So the constructions vary from context to context. But Terrio is a very interesting and unique case in some ways.
All right. I want to move to Colorado here.
Yeah.
Move to the film here. Our first thing that we see here, we see Patrick Swayze, we see Charlie Sheen in the film. And the Soviets invade almost immediately.
Almost immediately. Yeah.
Almost immediately.
There is a school shooting in this film. Right off the bat.
Yeah, you want to talk about that?
Sort of. I mean, sort of, right?
It's not Columbine.
No. But it is the shooting of a teacher right at the beginning. It's a history teacher, right?
It's a history teacher.
He makes it like 15 seconds or something in this movie.
Yeah, he's a history teacher. And it's very, you know, Millie is talking about, Genghis Khan,
yeah,
rounding up all these people. I mean, he's obviously making some very real things. You look at there's Theodore Roosevelt is all over the school early on.
Yeah.
You know, he's talking about and the Russians show up, the Soviets, I should say,
yeah,
show up and start attacking the school. I mean,
yeah,
immediately, right? Immediately.
And it's Nicaraguan paratroopers, I think, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Nicaraguan paratroopers, and we see them out the window of the classroom, just like landing as the kids in their desks are just like, what is happening? And they all go to the window to look, and the teacher gets shot in the head immediately. And then they run for it. And that's like, for a while, that's all we know that has happened is just that mm-hmm. like, paratroopers came into the school playground. Well, I guess, what would we call it at a high school? Outdoor space? Field? Anyway, they came into the school recreational facility area outdoors and then just opened fire. And then our main characters just like run, get in a pickup truck and run off to the mountains as quickly as they can.
Yeah, right. And of course, Milius is laying this out very quickly. You see the shot there with the bumper sticker. They can have my gun when they pry it from my cold, dead fingers. I mean, this is going to shock people from the director of Conan the Barbarian. Subtlety is not really a thing that he does.
Yeah. No, I think like from the first, I would have to go back and look, but from the first, like, I don't know, 4 minutes of action, we have gathered mm-hmm. that this is a family that very much values their weapons, that has resisted weapons regulations, that regularly practices Cold War evacuation / survivalist techniques and has been thinking about this moment for really quite a while before the movie begins, right? Like, I think they're ready.
Well, they are. And like Swayze mentions that like he's named after a mountain man. I want to say, you know, his character of Jed, I think after Jed Bridger, you know, he's named after that. We see other mountain men kind of name dropped in the film. This is quite literally they're heading into the mountains as their refuge throughout this. Right. And of course, when I was a kid,
yeah,
the thing we loved was the scene where they stopped by C. Thomas Howell's dad's store and they got all the stuff.
Yeah.
Right. They get all the things they need to. And there's another film that does this too, Commando, later on with Schwarzenegger, right? He stops yeah. by before he goes to get his daughter back. He stops by to get at the military surplus store and gets all the weapons that he needs, right?
Yeah, they get available. Like outfitted.
Right, right. You know, but here the guys are getting shotguns and rifles. They're getting a football, right? There's the shot of like that. They're getting all the things that makes you American in this store. And then they're fleeing.
Yeah.
From the mountains. And of course, that's going to come back to haunt the dad a little bit later on, right? So it's, they're very much playing with these. And of course, like the dad doesn't make it alone. Did you catch that when they were talking about like later on as they get to the concentration camp, they're talking about how his dad gets killed and why?
I forget why. Don't we see dad one more time getting beaten in the concentration camp? Or is that the storekeeper guy?
I know that like we see very early on, we see Colonel Bella, who is very sympathetic guy, right? Talking about, hey, go and get these forms, right? Get these forms of gun. Yeah.
Bella is Nicaraguan because they have to save the role of like the big bad guy to be Russian later.
Yes.
Yes. But so go
see,
on.
See, Nicaraguans are cute. Either way.
Bella might be Cuban. You're right.
Yeah. He's kind of romantic.
I think like, he's Cuban and the troops are Nicaraguan. And then like the really, really bad guy is Russian.
Yeah. The wolf hunter. He actually spoke Russian. So, because they show him, it's like, hey, go and get these specific forms. They will tell us who has guns and who does not. Right. I mean.
Right. Which is like the firearms registration concern, which figures very big in the white power movement. So another Cold War dystopian novel, The Turner Diaries, does that same thing where like the seizure of firearms is the first step that precedes like the societal collapse and then the later resistance effort by the white patriots. I'm not calling them patriots, just to be clear, they're calling themselves.
Right, right. Drew McKevitt talks about this.
Yeah.
In Gun Country. You know, he talks about this a lot about the usage of these terms and things like that. This paranoia to increase gun sales, but also to fight off registration and, you know, to keep these laws as loose as possible.
Right.
And you see that dead straight in 1984. There's a lot going on in this movie. We
haven't even gotten any female characters yet.
I was just about to ask you. Do you want to jump into that?
Anytime.
You want to go to the okay, let's go.
Thinking about this part.
Okay.
We asked about this in November, and I keep getting angry about it still. But go on.
Okay, that's good because you're several states away from me now. So that's I am.
Not a,
if you're listening not in, like I'm you. More safe now.
At one particular plot device that we will now discuss.
Okay. Let's. So our battles continue on. Our guys are doing well, and then they go to see one of the family friends who's got his granddaughter's little heirlooms to store with him.
He's like. They go to like find out what's going on in the town from this guy that I think he also has some supplies and some horses and stuff like that that they want.
He does.
And then he's like, oh, I have these special family heirlooms to keep safe. You should take them. And he opens the basement door flap thing. What is that called? The cellar door, trap door.
Yeah, cellar door. Yeah, trap door.
And under there are Leah Thompson and Jennifer Grey. They're the heirlooms that are to keep safe. And they're like disheveled teenagers who we are supposed to infer have been some amount of sexually assaulted. It's not totally clear, but they have definitely been wrongly treated by the invading troops and either threatened with or in fact assaulted. And so the grandparents are like, take them into the woods with you, teenagers. They'll be safer, which is amazing to begin with. And then go on.
Well, you know, there's a couple of things going on. The grandfather, did you recognize the grandfather?
I don't remember.
He's played by a guy named Ben Johnson, who is an old mainstay.
Oh.
Of the 50s and 60s Westerns.
Oh.
You would often see him as the friendly rancher or deputy in like the John Wayne-esque films of that era. So even the casting of Johnson is really is on purpose. He's a guy the audience certainly knows. I remember I would always watch these movies with my grandfather, who was Ben Johnson's age-ish. And I would, you know, recognize him immediately, right? So, all right, so... You know, guys immediately take the girls back to the mountains.
Yeah,
and
to their woods.
Kind of treat them thing. Treat them like shit.
Like, there's a little bit of stuff around like, don't tease me. I'm a survivor of something lightly, but you know, it's early 80s, so it's like between the lines rather than directly said. And then they meet a downed paratrooper, U.S. paratrooper. Played by
Powers Booth.
Powers Booth.
God, I love him. We have Powers Booth coming up in a couple of weeks on the Sunday Night Watch Party.
Why?
Did you ever see the movie Southern Comfort?
No, but I will.
It's on Prime right now. Oh, can I tell you real fast about it?
Yes, please.
Okay. Are you familiar with Deliverance, the film?
Yes, of course.
Okay. Basic idea, right?
Yeah.
Southern Comfort. It's shot in 1979, right?
Okay.
And essentially what it is, it's a bunch of Louisiana National Guard guys, right? Go out into the Louisiana swamps where they kill some Cajuns. And then the Cajuns like declare war on these National Guard guys.
What?
So, and these National Guard guys are like getting picked off left and right. They're infighting. They're not sympathetic at all.
No.
And wait,
who is Powers Booth in that movie?
He is a sympathetic. He is one of the few sympathetic National Guard guys.
Sympathetic National Guard guy. Okay. So in Red Dawn, he is supposed to be a dashing hero. He is
a dashing hero.
Okay. I'm pretty sure he's the only grown up in the group at this point because he has crashed into the teenage encampment. I guess Patrick Swayze might be like in his early 20s.
Swayze's like 20s. Yeah. Mid-20s.
Mid-20s, because his little brother's in high school. I think I mean, Swayze's the leader of the group. I suppose he's supposed to be in his 20s, but I don't know. I mean, I think for sure, if you're a paratrooper and you accidentally run into this group of teenagers hiding in the woods.
You're taking control.
You should probably assume command. That's definitely not what happened.
He kind of does. He becomes the mentor to Jed.
He just assumes Leah Thompson is what he does. He's like... Okay. And these are, so we quickly learn, this is the thing that bugs me the most about this.
Okay.
We quickly learn that he has a wife somewhere behind the lines and it's romantic, but maybe she's dead and maybe she's not dead. Da, 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 da. So first of all, he's married. Secondly, Leah Thompson has recently survived a sexual assault. It becomes clear. Thirdly, what is the other thing she doesn't know? It's like, she doesn't know the state names or something.
She doesn't know the capital of Texas.
Yes. She doesn't know the capital of Texas. So this is all he knows about her, is that she's a teenager. She's living in the woods.
Yeah, that's the other part that he knows. She's a
teen. The capital of Texas. And she is recently been the victim of an assault. And he's like, great, this is a perfect romantic partner for me, a man who has fallen into the woods. And then it goes on like that for a while.
Okay, I'm going to make you upset some more. You ready?
Yes.
You and I are both older than he was in this film.
Well, sure.
I just like, I see him now and I'm like, I still feel like when I watched this the other day for the 9th time since December, that he's older than me.
Like, yeah. Like, he's a young man. It's not like Powers Booth and Deadwood parachuting in there or something, but like.
Okay, that's fair.
But she is definitely a child and he is definitely an adult. So anyway.
Okay, here's my thing. This movie does extremely well. And as they are creating this film, they write this film and know they're going to sell it to a mass audience.
Yeah.
And there's an expectation that this is going to be okay. Right? There's no one back in the ground saying, hey, don't do
that. It's not even a thing. It's not even a thing in the film. Like, I didn't even remember it when I went to like watch this again for this podcast. Like, it hadn't occurred to me how inappropriate that relationship is. And I'm not trying to be like pearl clutching about it or whatever. It's a civil war. Things happen. Perhaps his wife is dead, but it is like an egregious like non-consent situation. Anyways, so we have a particular kind of gender politics. The two women in this movie with any kind of substantive parts are Leah Thompson, who is only interested in Powers Booth. That's the only thing that happens with her character development the entire movie. So obviously she's very sad when he dies. Sorry.
Yeah. Spoiler. Do you want to talk about what's not in the film?
Intimate.
They had to cut out?
What?
Yeah, there's an intimate scene. There was...
Well, maybe they did have to cut it out.
There was... according to IMDb, there was an intimacy scene between the two of them that got cut out because the audience said that was too far. So it could be implied.
There is a line that you cannot cross in 1984. That's good.
That line is pretty far down the road.
But they did have one. So good for you, 1984. That's long. Meanwhile, Jennifer Grey's character does nothing but glower and be bad at stealing stuff. That's all she does the whole movie.
Okay. There was an excise scene. There was an excise relationship between her and Swayze too, but you can only have so many why the appropriate relationship gets cut out, but the Powers
Booth inappropriate one not. Well, I mean, the other thing is like, we're so far from the Bechdel test here that it sort of doesn't matter. Like, it just, their only function is to sort of like occasionally symbolize a pioneer woman gazing out over the prairie, or to occasionally act as like sexual bait to get the Cubans or the Russians or the Nicaraguans to chase them and to hector the guys. That's all they do the whole movie, right? Am I missing anything?
Yeah.
I guess one time Leah Thompson brings a flower to somebody.
Yeah, she brings it to Powers Booth.
Yeah, but that's it.
Yeah. I want to ask you about Robert.
Okay.
And here's my note. I wrote this down for when we did this in Denver.
Okay.
Is Robert batshit crazy?
Okay, you're going to hate this, but it's been a minute. So remind me, which one is Robert?
Robert is C. Thomas Howell, the man, the young boy who slays his first deer.
Yes.
With Patrick Swayze.
Yes.
And Charlie Sheen. And then it's his dad who gets killed.
Yes.
It's his dad who owns the shop.
He's the survivor, right?
Well, he's the one who gets killed by the helicopter.
Oh.
He's the one in the classic. He's the one when we post this later, when we post this thread later on, when we post this, this on Twitter.
Yeah.
We're going to get 400 million people with the GIF of him yelling
Wolverines. Yes.
With the AK-47.
Yes.
Right.
I remember. I also, by the way, think it's, you seem to have opinions about this. So you tell me, do you think he's crazy?
Well, I don't think he's crazy initially, but I think he's driven mad. I think, being invaded, having his childhood torn away from him, and then, like, watching his dad. Like, there's the classic Harry Dean Stanton line, right? The avenge me scene.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, I don't mind that he goes crazy, but he goes
very crazy.
I think what his character does is to help demonstrate how even-keel Patrick Swayze remains.
Yeah.
Throughout the film, right? Like, we see Jed's the constant throughout the entire film, you know, and even in the end, you know, when they've got the monument rock, they know they're going to go die in that final scene. This movie's 40 years old. If you haven't seen it already, it's your fault. You know, if you're listening in now, like, they go and carve their name into the rock.
Sorry, not sorry.
Yeah. No, totally. Right. Yeah. But
they're sacrificing themselves for the good of America or something. Yes. Oh, well, we should also mention like the reason that they become important to like geopolitics in the story is that they become this group of child guerrilla soldiers that is like causing enough problems for the Cubans / Russians / I guess Nicaraguans, but the Nicaraguans didn't really get to talk. So anyway, they're causing enough problems by doing all of these guerrilla attacks that they become a strategic problem for the project for securing the heartland. And then they have to send in the Russian dude to try to get them. And then we get to my favorite like Americana moment in the whole movie where the guy gets killed because he doesn't know what an arrowhead is. The second in command guy is like walking around the rock trying to figure out about like, is this a natural rock? Is this, or what is it? I forget. But he's walking around like, looking.
Oh, it's bone polished to a fine sheen. It's like, he's like, this is,
it's the
one of the guys like, this is plastic.
I've ever seen. It must be plastic. And then boom, gotta know your Western stuff. Otherwise you're toast is the moral.
But you know, we see so much of this in the films. We see this with Rambo. I mean, now Rambo is quite literally, his character is supposed to be of Dene heritage. And yeah. I think they spell that out explicitly in the later films.
Very loud about it, even in the first one. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, but you know, you essentially have these very white presenting people
for sure
going to the mountains and quote unquote playing Indian, right? It's like we're back to defending our fascinating thing. Yeah.
They're in national forests. We can see the monuments. Mm-hmm. And do you want to tell us about the forests a little bit?
They're very green. They're very tall, these forests out here. So they're in Arapaho Roosevelt National Forest, and then part of what's called ARP, right? It's a managed together. It's the Arapaho National Forest, Roosevelt National Forest, and the Pawnee National Grasslands, which are all up in north of Denver area. And beautiful up there, right? You can go and survive. These guys are hunting mule deer up on the mountain. That's accurate. There are tons of mule deer everywhere, so forth. There are also marmots. And are you familiar with pikas? Do you know these things?
Pikas?
Yeah, it's little mice.
I was taught pika at summer camp, but my summer camp was unfortunately named Tomahawk Ranch. So let's all take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah, there's a lot of that still here.
Yeah, I know.
You know? Yeah, I mean, so quite literally, again, playing on these ideas of like going native to defend.
Wait, you know, have you eaten a marmot or a pika?
No.
Very squirrel-like.
Why would you assume that I'd eaten a marmot or pika?
Because you were talking about surviving on marmots and pikas.
I could survive on a mule deer. I mean,
well, yeah. But then you were also talking about marmots and pikas. I just want our listeners who are not from Colorado to understand that we've moved away from deer and into like chipmunk/groundhog size things.
I think I would just be annoyed at eating a pika.
Well, yeah,
they're very adorable. Like they're just too small.
They do the stuffing stuff in their cheeks thing.
Well, like if you go up on top of Pikes Peak, they are everywhere. And the marmots will bark at you.
Yeah, the marmots are pretty funny.
I like them very much. we will get into a full on. are there films, Kathleen, about angry rodents?
Angry rodents?
Yeah, the only one I think about is Splinter from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
I'm not coming in to talk about angry rodents.
Let's okay, fine.
No, I say pass on angry rodents.
All right, I have some statistics. Although, wait,
did you hear about the Chicago rat hole?
No.
We had a pothole in Chicago where I live where somebody paved over a rat and then it, you know, decayed. So it left a rat-sized hole in the pavement and it's a pothole shaped like a rat, except I think it's a squirrel, but it doesn't matter. Anyway, is that not the most Chicago thing you've ever heard?
I feel like it's a metaphor for something.
In the shape of a rat. Like if Pizza Rat is New York City, then Rat Hole is Chicago.
Did we talk about Chicago pizza last time you were here?
Maybe. Have you had Colorado Springs pizza?
No.
Okay, I'm really sorry, but I would not recommend.
What, Colorado Springs?
Yeah, it has like honey on it.
Oh, they do the honey thing out here on the crust out here. No, but there is a place in Colorado Springs. In Manitou Springs, in Old Colorado City, called Front Range Barbecue. Do you know this place?
Ooh, no, that sounds good.
It is a barbecue joint founded by two guys from Alabama, and it is.
You're just lucky for everything that's from the South that's in Colorado.
What?
I respect.
Yeah, I know all the things in the South in Colorado, including me.
Like you,
right? So
I get it.
There's, I guess, I don't want to be that guy who's so good here. Like I just. The neat thing about coming to Colorado and bringing food traditions from outside the state is we bring this thing called salt and also herbs and spices traditions. Just sad because there's such a great German presence. Like, you get up to Denver. Like, when I first started going back and forth to Denver, like, I had no idea, like, Denver is the West and stuff like that. When I think Denver is, like, this amazing city. And everything's named after this German dude or that German dude. I was like, and like where we were at in December, Whitcomb's got good food. Like, yeah. I legit like that place. And if they'd like to sponsor this pod, that'd be fine. But a little bit, like, when I moved to Pueblo, people were like, oh, it's so great. You've got Pueblo chilies down here, which is like a thing. But
Pueblo chilies are delicious.
They are, but New Mexico's got to be.
New Mexico and Pueblo chilies are very similar, but sure. Yes.
But
chilies are special.
I was in Albuquerque. Have you been there at all?
Oh, yeah. I love New Mexico.
All right. Okay. I went to Frontier Restaurant when I was there.
Frontier is legit.
Right. Yeah. Like 1/7 of my body weight is now a burrito. It's so bad. People are like, were you guys going to talk about a movie? Yes. It's called Chef. But all right. I have statistics for you. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right.
I was just thinking for a second about what else they eat, because I think they do get some food from when they get the girls. I think they get some other provisions. But then I realized they don't show much, like, they show some campfire, but they don't show much actually what they're eating except for the deer.
Right. They're complaining, right?
Because I'm in the movie. Through the winter, they're out there.
Yeah. And winter here is brutal. It's not easy. It's... Mm-mm. The hard thing up here is actually the seasonal depression, which is what I found.
Huh.
Because I had that in Minnesota when I was doing graduate school up there. But here, it's here as well. It's dark.
Yeah.
Early morning, it's dark in the afternoon. It's cold.
But you go out
kind of gray,
and it's sunny in the middle.
I didn't really do anything. Like, and I was feeling so bad because I was like, there's nothing to do in Colorado. People are like, are you out of your mind?
Outside. That's the thing about Colorado is everybody wants you to go outside. That's one reason that I am now a city girl in Chicago and not on a 14er right now.
You know what? I like to go in the 13ers just to throw just to do this to the 14. Because you're the person who put me on the Spanish Peaks.
Spanish Peaks is so pretty.
That's my jam.
It's beautiful.
Like those are my favorite mountains.
Yep. Okay, wait. So tell me your statistics.
All right. Okay. It's the very first film with a PG-13 rating.
Oh. And what gave it the rating? Do you know?
Well, it's closely associated with this next statistic. It is in the Guinness Book of World Records at the time for most acts of violence.
Ooh.
135 per hour, or 2.23 per minute.
2.23 per minute is really efficient. Wait, what is it tied with?
No, it set the record at the time. I'm sure something else.
I'm just curious what it would have tied with. That's amazing.
I don't know.
Okay, so it's very, very violent, which is interesting because, like, if just to think about the day after, which we were just talking about, I would consider the day after much more violent, but technically, I suppose there's only the one act of violence in it.
But that one act of violence ends all of humanity.
Right.
So there's that.
There is technically only one. So, like, per
minute, right.
It would be like, yeah. Anyway. Okay. So very violent. What else you got?
Those are the big ones. Those are the two big ones that I've got. I mean, this is actually, and I think that this movie, in a lot of ways, and I hate to turn this podcast serious for a second, but I'm going to. I think that movies like this that come out in the 1980s are seductive. I mean, this movie is, we were talking about this earlier. When you talk to people, like, I love this movie, right? And the reason why they have a certain feeling with it, it is a raw, the music is like rah, 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 rah.
Yeah.
The United States wins the war. The United States is standing alone, right? Except for, you know, Powers Booth is saying, it's like, except for England, but they won't do much, you know?
Yeah.
we're the last people to hold the fort.
Yeah.
And there's, I think, Kathleen, a numbing effect that happens.
For sure.
Societally.
Yeah.
As a result of what we're seeing in culture, right?
Yeah.
Seeing mass shootings with firearms.
Yeah.
Is not only okay, it starts to become normalized.
For sure.
Right? And you and I have talked about this. I've been wanting to write about this for a while. I haven't really gotten the guts to do it yet. I think this is maybe the second most dangerous film in the United States. In American history, maybe third. I really do. I think that Gone with the Wind, maybe Birth of a Nation. I think that this movie isn't, as much as I love this movie. Now I have to be clutching at my pearls, right? But I think this movie is absolutely dangerous.
It for sure is used that way. I think one way to think about it is instrumental. Like, how does a white power group grab this movie and use it as both as fuel that a leaderless resistance style terrorism could work, which is a cell style terror, which is what they're trying to do when this comes out. But also how it sort of expands the imaginary for violent acts in our culture. So I'm thinking of the word imaginary here as sort of like the menu of possible things that you might choose to do. And it's interesting because that, you know, an imaginary is bounded in all kinds of ways and people do expand it from time to time, but primarily we have a set of things that one might choose, right? But when we might think about like, it becomes more possible to shoot a teacher after viewing it over and over in Red Dawn, or it comes more possible to do something after you have this social exposure to it. So I wonder about that. And I also wonder about like, yeah, I don't know if I would put it at Red Dawn, but I agree that like in the 80s, you know, and people have been talking about this all the way back to like Susan Jeffords talking about remasculinization of America or the way that movies are where we exercise our demons of the Vietnam War. But whether it's the war creating the movies or the movies creating the aftermath, like certainly there is this repercussive effect of violence going through the 80s and into the 90s. And I think by the time we arrive at 1989, that's already very, very solid. So I agree with you. I've been thinking about it since you brought it up before about whether we would say like most dangerous. Most dangerous always makes me.
Most is difficult.
But I agree that it is an incredibly dangerous movie that has had huge aftermath effects. So like it's McVeigh, the Arizona Patriots loved Red Dawn. There's a bunch of other white power movement groups that have liked Red Dawn. Other terrorist actors have talked about Red Dawn. It's a very sort of hot button and a live movie for a particular set of people.
And, you know, like you were saying earlier, the vast majority of people who like this movie, just like movies, right? This is a mind-numbing, like let's get the bad guys, America wins, blah, blah, blah. It's fine. I like this movie. I can also watch it because I know it's complete nonsense and it's fine, right? You know, there's some parts, again, Powers Booth, Leah Thompson, a little weird. Like, not...
But like we said, maybe not on first viewing would you even notice. I don't know. You have to be very tuned into who's who in order to pick up that kind of thing. And the characters are to some extent interchangeable unless you're watching it over and over. Like,
yeah.
Here's
my working theory on this though.
Okay.
Right. I think that this movie tells a story.
Yeah.
That not only do you need guns, you average moviegoer need guns because the Soviets could invade, but you have to prepare for that, right? You've got to be ready for when the Soviets do. And in fact, I think this movie teaches people to savor that moment. I think that movies like Red Dawn, and maybe it's not Red Dawn exclusively, right? There's generations of films that reinforce these ideas that have really helped to create this resistance to making assault weapons harder to get. Right.
Sure.
I think movies like this, we can say the direct stuff like the Timothy McVeighs and these other paramilitary groups are horrible. Right. But I also think that when we look at, say, school shootings and things like that to kind of bring this back, say, to Columbine and things like that, the availability, I wonder, Kathleen, if the availability of a person who ordinarily is a normal person who just goes and does a bad thing all of a sudden. Well, they're only able to do this bad thing because they can get the ability to do those bad things. And I wonder if films like Red Dawn have an impact on the ability to access those kinds of firearms because it will build a resistance culturally to getting rid of those kinds of weapons.
Yeah. And I think I buy that. I also think like it's a key ingredient in why are people afraid of that regulation, right? Like what will happen if they are regulated? And the story we tell about like the potential doom of regulation of firearms is a story and it has these core texts. And I think Red Dawn is certainly one of those core texts. And I would put it up also against like, I think the other movies we would need to think with would be kind of like the vigilante films of the same period. So Dirty Harry and those kinds of movies that operate in some ways, much more openly white supremacist ways than something like Red Dawn. I think Red Dawn is also an important one for sort of hiding its frontiersman American project, which has, as we know, complex white supremacist material in it. But it's hiding that behind anti-communism in a way that is also very early 80s, very white power movement and very much in vogue at that moment. I still don't know about most dangerous films.
I know most is a hard word to say. It's it clicks, it gets it gets clicks, right? It's I'm wondering, do your students watch this film? Are your students familiar with this? I wonder about Gen Z or the more recent generations that have come behind.
I did teach a day after, and that was incredibly hard for them. And I ended up going on Twitter just to say, like, hey, anybody remember seeing this? And I got like thousands of people saying, oh my God, I still can't sleep.
I remember when you tweeted that.
Yeah, people were like really impacted by the day after. But my students now, you know, don't remember 9/11. So we're way out from direct experience of the 80s. And we're certainly like, I don't know though, like sometimes movies that are around, you know, in the zeitgeist have followings that I don't anticipate. So tell us in the comments, if you are a younger listener, tell us if this is a movie that you remember. I would love to know.
Yeah, I think this movie kind of floats around. There are some other stuff like we'd seen, and I know that you know this, Red Dawn becomes the code name for the military operation to get Hussein.
Yeah.
More recently, have you seen what the Ukrainian army has been doing?
No.
They've been painting Wolverines on Russian tanks.
What? Well, I have so many follow-up questions about, first of all, are there mercenaries involved in doing that? Because that's the other through line from white power then to white power now. And we do know that there have been extensive mercenary activities on both sides in Ukraine. And then my other question is, like, is that, I wonder if that even works as part of like a propaganda effort to try to get Americans involved. And it's just such an interesting like Cold War redux of all kinds of different thematics right now.
You see it pop up on video games a lot, but of course video games are no longer like these first person shooter kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You'll see references to pull up. You'll hear guys yell Wolverines.
Really?
From here. Oh yeah. But again, guys my age, mid-40s, are playing video games alongside teenagers, right? So there's an operational knowledge of this particular film.
We have to tell them what happens in it.
At the end of the movie?
Yeah.
Well, you know, so there's a couple of things that go on, right? So the Soviets end up, you know, they bring in the Wolverine, the hunter, right? The guy who's like
a Russian
who figures out he's the guy, right? And they start picking off the Wolverines. We see Descent in the mix. There's a guy who gets betrayed. And of course,
people who don't follow commands and try to Jennifer Grey, I think, goes scavenging for food and tries to take too much and they catch her. And then doesn't she explode herself and take them with her?
No. Well, that's they're hanging out. But there's a scene there. There's a couple things, right? One, when they kill the mayor's kid.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know. And they're like, you know, they've got him and their captioned Russian soldier and they're about to shoot him. And they're like, you know, why is it okay for us to kill him or whatever? And he's like, you know, because we live here. You know, there's very much these ideas of this, right? And of course, you know, they kill Robert ends up killing their own guy. And eventually we have a two-man suicide mission.
Right.
That goes into the camp to kill off all the Soviets and everybody else like that. And like they know they're going to die going into it. But we have a good guy. We've got a good bad guy.
Yeah.
Right? We've got Bella, who's like writing to his wife, right, about how he misses her and how he's tired of this war. I kind of wonder what the point of Bella is. Is Bella showing the injustice of war?
Yeah, like, what is he doing? Like somebody has to make the Russian bad guy worse than the other bad guys, I think.
Yeah.
And I also think like there is this like deep cultural belief that some of the Soviet satellite states like Cuba and Nicaragua have just been manipulated into being communist states. And actually, if they were really shepherded properly by, say, the United States, they would choose a different political outcome for themselves. So I think it's a mix of all of that stuff. So Bella's writing to his wife. Go on.
Yeah. And then, of course, we've got the guy, our big bad is William Smith, who plays Colonel Strelnikov, right? Who is Spetsnaz. Right? He's the guy who hunts them down. And of course, we finally get down to Swayze versus this guy. And he waits to turn around and says, you lose.
Yeah. When he could have
shot him.
Back.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is the moment that we ended up discussing with my movie cousin right after our podcast. My cousin who works on movies and has worked on films with people like Tarantino and stuff. So,
right.
Okay. And he was like, he really feels that we have to suspend disbelief because it's for narrative purposes. But
that's fair.
Well, I don't know. I think I might disagree. And we can talk later, cousin, who I will not name without your permission. But cousin, we'll talk about it later if you want to.
Cousin, but Colorado cousin.
My cuz. So I don't know if it works for me to leave it there because I feel like the violence is the one thing that they consistently respect in this movie. Do you know what I mean? Like the violent act and like the way the violent act ought to unfold is like the one rule they don't break except for at the very end. Like they don't go around being like, oh, actually this hand grenade didn't kill the guy or something. You know what I mean? Like, or yeah, he fell out of the thing, but he's fine. Or like the guy got tortured, but he's going to make a comeback. Or like there are movies that take license with violence, but this one does not. This one is very much like you're dead, you know? So I thought it's such a weird, it's an unsettling thing at the end. Maybe it's supposed to be an unsettling thing. And that's why it's that way.
It always bothered me as a kid that we don't actually see them die on the brothers die on screen. It's implied. It's obvious they're going to. Charlie Sheen's pretty much gone.
Yeah.
At the very end. But I always made believe that they survived. But I think Milius needs. Oh yeah, as a child, yeah, absolutely.
So like secretly they survive, and meanwhile they're
the good guys. Good guys live.
The only ones we know live are. Leah Thompson and what's his face, who are like
Bobby.
Walking into the West and like looking over the plains and
Danny.
It's yeah. Like Pioneer Vista. It's like, we are going to settle the new civilization out here in the West. And it's very, I don't know, it's very Manifest Destiny / something in that moment.
Yeah. There's always these allusions to like the where the Americans have got the Soviets caught. They got the Russians caught right there in Colorado.
Yeah.
But the fighting was still tough. Like,
yeah. And they're behind the lines, but the Americans are going to win, we are told. And then at the end, we see the Martyrs Rock,
yep.
Which is where they wrote their names on the rock. And that's how we know mm-hmm. that they died, isn't it? Do we see their names,
yeah.
Brothers, on the rock?
Well, I mean, Swayze had carved his own name on there.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
right. Right before they went on their mission.
Oh, I see. So you could make believe that maybe he carved his name on there and then didn't die after all.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
You could. I mean, I did because I wanted to. It's Patrick Swayze, you know. I don't like Patrick Swayze getting killed. I'm like, that will do a ghost pod and I'll cry the whole time. So, you know, that's not fair to me.
I get it.
All right. I wanted to ask you this. Are there parts of film that do resonate with you? That do you like this movie? How do you feel about this movie? Like, we've talked about this movie a lot, and I'm really looking forward to talking about another movie at some point in time. But like,
let me put it this way: this is no cleaner for me. I don't have a secret love of this movie.
No,
but I understand what people like about it. Like, I think I can watch this movie, and I mean, more so than Rambo, which I find like Rambo is a similar genre. It's at a similar historical moment. And that one, you know, the first one is more interesting than some of the later ones, but they become just sort of pageants of violence that unfolds forever without ever resolving anything, you know? And this isn't quite like that. Like, this is interesting. It has much more of a narrative arc to it. It has a lot more characters in it. So I'm interested in it for all of the reasons that I think, you know, all those reasons, but also that it depicts Colorado at a moment when I was alive in Colorado and I'm like, oh, interesting that they would pick here, you know? But it's not like I don't think of it as, it wasn't one that I saw as a kid a lot, probably because of the violence. And it's one that I've only encountered as a historian of this. So I don't know if I can, I don't know.
You bring up a good point on Rambo though.
Yeah.
Right. Rambo, the Rambo series is super disappointing to me because I think that the first film and maybe even the second to a degree have a lot to say, certainly about Vietnam and our relationships yeah. to, you can really talk about them in terms of the other films that are coming out about Vietnam, the 1980s. You
for
can
sure.
talk about Born in the USA.
Yeah.
They are remarkable. You can talk about PTSD, all this kind of stuff. They are, I think actually quite intellectual.
The first one, especially.
The first one, right. Especially. Yeah.
But then it goes into this whole other thing.
Where, no, you're
like, look, reasonable people, even Rambo fans, can we agree that you cannot pull a helicopter out of the sky with your hand? Right? You can't. You cannot, even if you're Rambo, you cannot. Jason thinks he can. He's looking at his hands and deciding. But
I'm just going to guess
that most people cannot. That's all I'm saying. So like there is this sort of like it leaves reality and starts doing something else at a certain
point. It becomes a superhero film and overtly racist one at that.
Yeah.
By the end of the series, it's bad.
Yeah.
All right. I want to pull this to a close with a couple of last little thoughts.
Okay.
You wrote your first book. What are you working on now? Like, what are you doing?
So I'm working on a book about how do we get to the moment of the Columbine shooting and collectively respond with thoughts and prayers. This is when that slogan comes into circulation rather than action or societal change. And there's actually a robust history of opposition to school shootings before Columbine. There's a lot of other examples. There's a lot of other kind of ideas in the hopper. And then we get to Columbine and it's like the pendulum it's like a fulcrum we've flipped over, you know? So I'm interested in how we get to that moment after which we have this just grim roll of shooting after shooting after shooting. So to look at that, I'm looking at Colorado in the 1990s and kind of tracing politics, space, spatial formation, the structure of the suburbs, the way religion and politics are colliding, and then a number of other sort of histories of violence to bring us up to 1999. So it's also where I grew up, and I'm interested in sort of understanding what I saw at the time through my historian brain. and also just, I think it is, for me, an exercise in trying to figure out the contingency around school shootings and mass shootings that still exists and thinking about how history in this case might help us to reveal some possibilities that wouldn't be visible to us from where we stand.
We talked about, we name dropped Drew McKevitt the other day, a friend of both of ours, right? Who wrote Gun Country. It's a terrific book. We really should. I'm quite literally looking at it on my desk as we're talking. Are there other stuff that you've read recently that's kind of blown you away that you've been like, hey, this is good stuff that people should be reading?
Like new stuff? Really... I don't get to read.
Yeah, like new stuff that you've read that's influential on the way that you think, you know?
Yeah. I'm
assuming everyone here's already purchased your first book.
Oh, that's really nice.
Mine is signed. So go on.
Well, thanks. I really like Fortress America by Elaine Tyler May.
I love Elaine.
I love that book. It's so good. About all the different ways the Cold War shapes our imaginations and our lived reality. So things like how the cul-de-sac is because of fear of the bomb and like the tidy house is because of fear of the bomb. And the way that it just permeates. So I love that book. That book I go back to all the time. There's a new Jennifer Carlson book called Merchants of the Right. I think she's a sociologist actually, but it looks amazing. That's the top of my stack right now. And then I've got a new, I've got a fascism anthology on my desk and I've got the new, there's a new book on the history of DARE as policing.
I have that.
Yeah, it looks great. I can't wait to read that.
Yeah, I'm trying to get him on to do 21 Jump Street.
Oh, that would be cool. Or The Karate Kid. But 21 Jump Street would be awesome.
Yeah, I think it'd be fun.
Yeah,
so
that would be cool.
All right, let me ask you this. Our final question here.
Yeah.
Is Red Dawn a history movie?
Oh, for sure. I think Red Dawn is both important as a primary source, but I also think it is narrating American history and narrating this moment of kind of like the anti-communist Reagan 80s. In a really specific way. Yeah.
Yeah. It's fascinating. I would love to hear if your students end up watching it sometime, I would love to hear their thoughts because I want to hear what the next generation have to, this is an old movie to them. This movie's 40 years old now, but I think it's really relevant still.
Yeah. If people listen to the podcast, if you've seen this movie and you are a younger person, I would love to know about it on Twitter or in the comments, please tell us what you thought about it. Or if you're listening and maybe you'll be inspired to go out and find out about the Wolverines, please tell us how it sits with you. I would be very interested to know.
Yeah, absolutely. And where can people find you on the Twitters and other spaces?
On X or whatever, I am at Kathleen_Ballou. I am also occasionally on TikTok now.
Saw that.
I know. I don't know. I don't know how much I'm going to be doing that. Mainly people on TikTok want to talk about grammar. And I mean, I can do that all day, but it is not technically my job to do it. So maybe we'll see.
I can't really figure TikTok out.
If people want to be over there and talk about the Oxford comma with me, come on over. I don't know.
It's a rollicking good time, Kathleen Belew.
Yeah, and you can actually see a film I contributed to right now. It's a documentary called Against All Enemies, which is premiering in the U.S. I think it just broke last week, but it's a great time to go view that if you would like to know more about the infiltration of the armed forces by white power groups, which is a problem we will continue to face this election season.
And on that happy note, thank you for being here and hanging out for our seventh time we tried to do this. We got it down.
So glad we did it. Thank you for having me.
You were the best. Thank you always.
And that's a wrap here at Historians of the Movies podcast. Thank you so much to our guest, Kathleen Belew. Kathleen, it is always fun to sit and hang with you. I know we've got another pod coming up soon, so everybody sit back and relax. We've got some more stuff coming for you from Kathleen. Thank you, of course, to our producer, Fletcher Powell, for making this show operate. Fletcher, there's a Red Dawn analogy in there for you somewhere. I have no idea where it is, but whatever. Wolverine's Fletch. And thank you, of course, to you guys for continuing to listen to this podcast, for sharing it with your friends, for continuing to make it the success that it is. If you like this pod, if there are guests that you want to have on this pod, please do let me know. Share it on Twitter, share it on social media, Blue Sky, wherever it is. Share it with your friends. Thank you so much for being part of this movement that we are trying to create, where we talk about history and film and everything else in between. So, guys, this was a blast. Ciao for now.